Hello, everyone. Welcome to this latest episode of Three Sides to Every Adoption. My name is Lori Holden, and I am here with the voice of one adoptive parent. And I'm joined by Sarah Easterly, the voice of an adoptee, and Kelsey Vandervliet Renyard, a voice of a birth mom. And we are here today to talk about perhaps one of the thorniest issues to talk about. It's like walking through a brambles field to try to have a thought-provoking conversation about abortion. And we're not talking about the whole big wide world of abortion. We are drawing lines around this. We are talking about abortion as it relates to adoption, because there's a lot of times where this is commingled and conflated, and we're going to enter into that space. This is a really tough topic to talk about for a lot of reasons. One, it's so polarized. People have really strong feelings on either side. The people who are on extreme sides tend to be very vocal about it. And as we know, with adoption, there's a lot of nuances and complexities in the center, in the middle, and we are going to get into some of those. It's also a tough topic to talk about because it's so very personal. It gets into our very identity of who we are, who we relate to, our tribe. There's the intersection of religion, of politics, of our whole identity. So we are going to go there, and I'm really excited to see, to learn from my colleagues here and maybe hear from you as well. So Sarah, what do you have to say? I know you have some feelings also about the difficulties in talking about abortion as it relates to adoption. So talk to us about that.
Thank you, Lori. You said that so well that I feel like you just kind of reached in and said a lot of the things that were on my heart too. I will add that it feels incredibly dangerous anytime I personally write or speak about this topic, for all the reasons that you mentioned, Lori, but you know that it's so intense and politically heated and it's such a divisive issue in our country, with so much potential for emotional backlash, but also because as an adoptee whose adoptive family has very vocal beliefs around abortion, anytime I stand up for my personal beliefs out loud, whether it's on the page or in a forum like this, I face incredible separation at the very deepest level. In my mind as an adoptee, there's always a chance that something I say will be the final straw that will just make our differences too big to bridge, and will sever me from my adoptive family forever. And then I'll have to go through the family loss all over again, which might seem silly. I'm almost 50 years old, but that's still very primal for me. So if I'm nervous today, that's why. It brings up a lot of stuff for me personally. I will also say that today is the 8-year anniversary of my mom's death. So it feels like speaking today is creating a divide on a day that I really want to feel close to my mom, not apart from her. But it also feels important to speak about it today because it's time sensitive right now, with the very real possibility that Roe v. Wade will be overturned. And because shame and secrecy are totally at odds with closeness. So just a few thoughts.
I just want to honor that this is a hard day for you. And I want to honor your mom. I know how much you love your mom from reading your book. Kelsey, do you have anything you want to start with?
Yeah, so this is a super sensitive topic for me as well. I know when you first, like if you're a birth mom and you first place your child for adoption, you kind of can be inundated. It depends on what like circles that you're in. But if you were grew up in like a very religious community, you can kind of be inundated with, tell me your story. Thank you for choosing life. And like all of this, these narratives that they want to place on you. And whether or not that's true, sometimes it doesn't really matter. You're still going to get that. I think the thing that really sticks with me is that not all of us chose life. And we didn't, I read this quote the other day, and I think it's from Gretchen Sisson. I think that's her name. She said, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. So sorry, Gretchen, if I'm pronouncing your last name wrong. but she said something like, adoption is the ultimate expression of choicelessness. And I feel like saying like, thank you for choosing life and doing all of this for like, is kind of using birth moms in a political debate without really truly seeing us and seeing the real problems that lie underneath our very limited choices. And so it just kind of, this whole thing reminds me that I'm not that far away from where I was before when I was pregnant with my child that I was going to place for adoption. And in a way, this debate brings me back in kind of a terror to that time where it was very scary, very lonely. And it's like you feel unsupported and used all over again. And so I know it's a hard thing for birth moms. I know a lot of birth moms that chose adoption for this pregnancy, but not for others, and maybe chose to terminate or chose to parent. And the fact is that everybody makes different choices. And it's a really hard world to navigate when we're so polarized. It's a really hard world to just walk through when you feel like there's these mines, these landmines everywhere with people on who they're gonna, what they're gonna judge you on, and you know how much weight they believe their opinions have on you and stuff like that. So.
Thank you for sharing that, Kelsey. And I also just wanted to point out that you also bring the perspective of adoption professional to this conversation as well.
Yeah. So as an adoption professional, it's also really scary. I feel like I've thought of myself as like compartmentalized a lot of times of I'm a birth mom and over here I'm an adoption professional. But the truth is those two things really bleed together. So my adoption professional side, where I work in, you know, the public policy side, my birth mom side really like makes that side of me panic a little bit, because I know that this adoption field for private adoption in the United States is just so not ready. And if there were to be an influx of women kind of flooding the field of adoption, which I hope is not the case, but if that were to happen, I really truly believe that it would be devastating for these women and these adoptees as well as they grow up, because our education is severely lacking. The cost of adoption is so high. The post-placement availability and programs for birth moms is embarrassingly bad. The protections that are just not in place for women in families as well, sending them home with this bundle of joy that they have no idea what lies underneath and where these kids come from and what they are going to need, and have them so ill prepared to take these children home. It's very scary on all fronts if this does in turn affect adoption in that way. Of course, I don't know. It's kind of a wait and see thing. And of course, the official opinion isn't out yet, so we're still waiting on that as well. But it's a scary thing. I think everybody, my colleagues that are like highly respected in adoption, are all kind of feeling the same way. I think that there's a lot of adoption professionals that are probably foaming at the mouth, for lack of a better phrase. But I think that's the perfect phrase. Anyways, but yeah, and it's really scary because it always feels like a us versus them thing in the field with professionals, is like, we want to be the good guys who want to keep striving for better and do better by our clients and by these families and these kids and these moms. But like, there's a whole other section of adoption professionals that are gonna, they're just trying to make a buck. And it's really just.
Can you draw that line really clearly, Kelsey, for people who maybe are new to thinking about this, not as a moral issue, but as a, there's a financial profit motive here for people to bank big money. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. Well, so like we talked about in our previous episodes, we have a whole group of unlicensed professionals in the United States. We like to call them baby brokers because that's truly what they are. They don't have a license to be a licensed agency or an attorney to practice law. They're just like put up a shingle and that they have a business now. And I guess in this modern day, they put up a website and they have a cell phone, a number they can, that you can call, and they get paid for the match. They're getting paid tens of thousands of dollars for doing essentially zero work. They are kind of sticking their nose where they shouldn't be. And in the same way, though, that's not to automatically see the adoption field in a binary way. It doesn't mean that all licensed professionals are good, but it does mean that once you get into the realm of licensed professionals, you now have a whole different thing of, okay, who are the good guys? Who are the people that are doing the right thing? And so it's not enough just to say use a licensed professional. You have to use someone that's trusted. But that's what makes this whole thing so tricky. That's what makes us not ready for a potential influx of women needing to place their child for adoption. It makes it scary because it's a minefield. It's literally, you don't know what you're going to get. And it may be very dependent on where you live, where you're at when you Google search for help with adoption. People are advertising falsely, portraying themselves as licensed agencies when they're not. And no one's really doing anything about it to enforce these things. And so women are at the mercy of their Google search. They're at the mercy of the first phone number that they decide to call. And they have no idea what they're up against. And those unlicensed professionals especially really like it that way because that's how they make their money.
So. And they can make more money if more babies are carried and desperate women are preyed on.
Right. Yeah. So Sarah, I know that this issue is really personal to you in a different way. Is that something that you'd like to share?
Yeah, I'd be happy to share. Thanks, Kelsey. And I think, you know, it was interesting hearing you speak because, you know, you used the words us versus them mentality. And I think that that's really true. I mean, I think what's interesting that I was thinking about just from my perspective, I'll start with this first, and then I'll answer your question about the personal, is just that adoption and abortion are so often kind of pitted against each other as if they're opposite sides of the coin when it comes to pregnancy decisions. But there are actually a lot more similarities than we tend to think in adoption and abortion. Both have aspects of classism and racism. There's shame and secrecy that tend to go hand in hand with either adoption or abortion. Both adoption and abortion come with a lot of disenfranchised grief, grief that's not generally recognized. You know, and what I mean by that is, like, does someone bring a casserole to an adoptee? That would be a lifetime of casseroles, or to a birth mother, or to a woman who's just had an abortion. And the answer is pretty much no for all of those. So then you know that these are losses that aren't generally acknowledged in our culture, which is what disenfranchised grief is. So, and I will say that for adoptees, that grief that grief lasts a lifetime. We just talked about that in our last episode that we recorded with Dr. Gordon Neufeld. So anyway, I just wanted to just kind of, that was just some thoughts that were percolating while you were speaking, Kelsey. In terms of personal, to just take us, you know, from the broader to the personal, I will say that I was born 4.5 months before the Roe v. Wade decision. I was adopted domestically when I was 2 days old. For most of my youth and continuing to this day, as I alluded to earlier, my family, my adoptive family has been pretty vocal about their anti-abortion beliefs and my life being a tribute to adoption. I absorbed a lot of judgment toward women facing unplanned pregnancy, and I will just note, never toward the man. And so growing up under these influences and with that black and white thinking around adoption and abortion, I'd picked up on this indirect message that my birth mother was a really shameful person, having birthed me as a teenager and presumably having shameful premarital sex to do so. And as I entered my teen years and began to individuate, I had what I now know is a fairly typical adoptee identity crisis. I grew up without any genetic mirroring. So all that I had to go on of who am I and what will I be like were my fantasy ideas of this promiscuous birth mother. And unconsciously, I wanted to be just like that fantasy birth mother. And then at the same time, in a lot of ways, I was this good adoptee, a term coined by Betty Jean Lifton, just trying to win my parents' love and be the daughter that they needed because I couldn't risk the loss of a second mother. So those two things combined, when I found myself pregnant in my early 20s, there was no way I could risk telling my mom, just back to that shame and secrecy. I know a lot of adoptees who've experienced unplanned pregnancies, many of whom have had abortions. The national statistic on abortions is that 1 in 4 women have had an abortion. This is an area where I wished we had better data on adoptees, just an aside. My hunch is that for adoptees, that number might be slightly higher because there's so much that goes on for us psychologically. I don't have any hard concrete data to back that up. And I certainly am not speaking for all adoptees, of course, but I'll share more about the psychology around my unplanned pregnancy in case it's helpful for this conversation. And I hope that it is. And I will say, I want to caveat that I'm not a wholehearted advocate of abortion either. I've been a lifelong rescuer of baby turtles, prairie dogs, ladybugs. I just this morning rescued a moth. I currently care for 10 rescue animals, and there's a whole legacy of others behind them. So abortion in some ways feels like it goes against my innate nature. And when I faced an unplanned pregnancy, and I look back on the decisions that I had to face, I would have been a terrible mother had I gone through with that pregnancy. Adoptees can take a really long time to mature. I wouldn't have even been able to look at my adoption up close for another 15 years into the future. And I had to do so in order to be emotionally healthy. It would have been a recipe for disaster and an inhumane spreading of generational trauma to a child. To become a mother in that state, which is not very life-giving. And I was in the adoption fog at that time, living my life pretty emotionally numb. So I didn't necessarily have this like consciousness to be able to articulate this at the time, but I did have my lived experience as an adoptee to compare to, and it hadn't been easy. I'd lived my life feeling rejected, feeling unwanted, suicidal, crazy, not knowing that a lot of the dynamics I felt were just pretty much par for the course for adoptees. I really felt that I was crazy. I felt lonely. I felt like a misfit. I felt like I was too sensitive and too much for this world, all those things at once. I've had, and I still have a nervous system that's default is on fire. I felt on the outside spiritually. At the age of 5, here's an example. At the age of 5, I played Mary in a school play and I was holding a doll as baby Jesus. And so there's just all these mixed messages. I was learning that the mother-child bond is holy, but not for me. And so even though I heard the story of God's will to bring me to my adoptive family, and by the way, my family's amazing, just because I know that's something that's always assumed and easily discounts adoptee perspectives if if we can just kind of write off the family. My family, my adoptive family was fabulous, but it still was deep down really hard to see that a loving, caring God would take me away from my first mother. That's all at a different level. That's not at the mind level. That's at the heart level. So life as an adoptee comes with a lot of spiritual isolation as well. So I think we hear a lot from anti-abortion activists about the suffering of a fetus, but I don't think I have ever heard them acknowledge the suffering of an adoptee. I think, and I knew about that suffering firsthand. It was in the back of my mind as I weighed my options. And so I did proceed to have an abortion for kind of, that's kind of the backdrop of all those, things that were at play, influencing my decision.
Thanks for sharing that, Sarah, because it's such a sensitive, experience and something that we like carry with us forever. And I always tell people, when they talk to me about unplanned pregnancy, like pregnancy is the point of no return, because you then have to make a choice. And a lot of times our choices are slashed. Our choices we don't all have the same free choices. That's kind of a myth. And we want to be able to provide a space in this country, in this world, where women do have free will and choices, but in the present day, that's just not the reality. And for you to freely, you know, exercise your choice, and be able to talk about it too, is something that we're super grateful for. So thank you. I did want to talk about the mental health of a mother, because I've had two unplanned pregnancies, and I'd love to plan one someday, by the way. But yeah, I've had two unplanned pregnancies, and the mental health of carrying both of those pregnancies to term was very debilitating. I've placed a child for adoption. I parent my daughter, and both times it has been really just kind of devastating. In my first pregnancy, I got fired for being pregnant. I was very sick in both pregnancies. My second pregnancy, I had to quit law school, which was my dream for years to go, and I had to quit after my first year. It's still something I struggle with. This week, all my friends are graduating law school and I'm not. And I think that we really tell women that they can do it all. And the reality is that we live in a place where it's not conducive to do even one thing sometimes as a woman. And those things are those factors are changed even when, you know, you, depending on your level of privilege, your race, your socioeconomic status, and all of these different factors play into what you're really able to do with your life. And so the debilitation mentally of an unplanned pregnancy can be catastrophic for women, because I've struggled with suicidal ideation in both pregnancies. I've definitely been the one that's prayed for a miscarriage. And it's really difficult to sit here and tell women in my mind that they can't terminate, they can't even have that option, because I think that we really discount the heavy trauma and the massive monumental shift that is happening in this woman's life. And to force her to carry a pregnancy to term is catastrophic, because I think, I know a lot of people don't want us to talk about, like, you know, this could be bad for the foster care system, for those children that are going to be, that may pour into the foster care system. And I think we have a tendency to say, well, I'm not an abusive person, or I'm not neglectful, or it's like a us versus them thing once again. But I think that we really don't grasp the effect of continuous neglected trauma in a person and how that changes that person's, it rewires their brain. It changes their personality. It changes their tendencies. It changes their bandwidth and makes them into a person that they never thought that they would or could be. And so it's important to humanize everybody in this discussion and realize that the long-term effects of taking these women's choices away, no matter what choices they are, it's the impact on society, I really do believe it could be devastating. Lori, what are you thinking? Because I think that this is always the us versus them thing too, is with birth moms and adoptive moms, because I hear adoptive moms a lot of times, they feel that inner conflict of the infertility piece. And I always feel like a broken record, like reminding people like, hey, but my pregnancy isn't really about all of you. And my struggles aren't all about all of you. Just like your struggles aren't about me either. So what are you thinking? Because I'm curious to know.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And just circling back, Sarah, thank you so much for sharing so many brilliant pieces of that. But let me get back to what Kelsey was asking. It's so tricky if you've come to adoption through infertility, because I can remember going through trying to create life, which is like the opposite of an unplanned pregnancy. You know, it's, some people get the feast and some people get the famine, and it's really hard to understand the other side when you're so deeply on one side, and trying to create life. I have really mixed feelings on the issue. I do feel like taking any of the choices off of the plate, you know, is a disservice to women and to our cult, our society. I do bristle at the idea that the reason we should have people carry their pregnancies is to serve infertile people who want to adopt babies. I just think that's a stream that, two streams that should not intersect. They should be kept separate. One is, no human beings are in service to other human beings at a fundamental level like that.
Thanks, Lori. And I do, I just want to quickly say to both of you, thank you. When I shared, neither one of you asking me, aren't you glad you weren't aborted, which I appreciate that I'm in a in this circle where questions like that are not asked of me.
Well, that brings up the question, Sarah, because I hear this a lot online. I see it a lot online where when people are making their case for pro-life, they ask adoptees, would you rather have been aborted? How does that come across to somebody who was adopted?
You know, any of us could be, any one of us who are alive and breathing right now could be asked that question. So, you know, I think what's frustrating about that question is it's unfair to adoptees to suggest that our life has to be proof of one belief system or another, that we as adoptees don't get the same right to think critically around these issues and honor the complexity of the decisions around unplanned pregnancy as non-adopted people. So, you know, what I guess, you know, what it lands is it takes out the nuance for us that, and I think what's frustrating about that is we keep kind of pointing these happy sunshine rays over at adoption and pretending like it solves abortion. And the reality is that neither is an ideal rainbows and unicorn solution, and both have some good and some bad with them, right? Like everything. So it just takes away the choice. Another one that comes up a lot, and maybe this is for both of you to respond to, just while we're on the topic of these kind of uncomfortable things that we hear in this conversation, is around God's will. It was God's will for me to have this baby. I guess, Lori, I'll start with you. You know, we hear that a lot too. How does that, what are your thoughts around that as from an adoptive parent's perspective?
Yeah, there's a lot of meant to be in adoption land where there's such a rightness when a baby joins your family and it feels like it was meant to be. But it's a narrative that if you look at it a little bit deeper, God's will is everywhere or it's nowhere, because what gets thrown at adoptive parents sometimes is, well, it's God's will that you're infertile. And so it feels to me like taking it as God's will in one situation that serves you and taking it as a horrible mistake in a situation that doesn't serve you is not, it's not congruous.
God's will in my case is, I feel really similar, obviously, to Lori, is if God's will was for me to be pregnant and fired from my job and all of the things that happened and very sick, if that's God's will, then like me and God have some issues to work through, because I just don't know, I guess, what I did to God for that to be God's will. And why, I guess like this is a theological argument, but it just seems, it's classist, it's racist, it's classist to look at the, you know, we have very limited data on adoption and those kind of stats, but it just seems when you look at the populations that are placing their babies for adoption or the populations that are needing abortions and stuff like that, like God's will is pretty, God's will is like a caste system in that way. And I, that's not really a theology that I subscribe to.
Yeah, I feel like we probably, you know, it's impossible to have this conversation without getting into theology a little bit, right? I mean, and which is not really what we're here to do. We're talking about, you know, adoption and abortion, but it, again, we just, it's just really hard to separate because there's so much religion behind this. I think what I will just say, one thing that kind of frustrates me about all of these conversations is, you know, just, and I know we all have different beliefs in this room and of our listeners too. So I want to be honoring of that, but I will say that when we get so black and white of, you know, God's will, or we're also forgetting about free will, the concept of free will. And we're also, we're oversimplifying God. I mean, whether, if you believe in God, like look around the world, it's really complex. Like it's a really, really complex place. And there's so much, like nothing simple and straightforward. And so it's, and that the same is true of all of these things we're talking about. So, you know, just taking nuance out doesn't really, it's suggesting a God who lacks complexity. And, I guess my personal bias is that we've got a God with a lot of complexity and big arms to be able to handle all of it.
Since this episode is on abortion as it relates to adoption, let me just throw up like a big question. I think people are making a lot of assumptions about it. Will restricting access to abortion in some states mean more, significantly more adoptions? What happens to the women who have that choice taken off their menu? Will they all turn to, you know, who will turn to adoption? Who will parent? Who will,
I think that's
an illegal termination.
So I think that that's something we've yet to see. I think that a couple different things factor into what made the baby scoop era, which was post-war before Roe. I think there's different circumstances that factored into it being what it was. There was the maternity home situation. There, I mean, women couldn't even have a credit card back then. So there was, they couldn't even legally have a credit card separate from their husband. So the entire realm of a woman's independence was very different. It was a totally different era. And women's rights were still kind of in infancy, if you think about it. So I think that, will we go back to that? No, I don't think so. I also desperately hope that we don't. But I do think it's logical to look at the modern day and know that we're not as advanced as we think that we are. And that if women are given a very small, narrow set of choices, and limited resources and access to things like abortion, then adoption is going to seem like the more logical choice for them to make if they're not prepared in any way to take a baby home with them, or it may not be safe for them to do so. I think that it's going to depend on the state also, because I know that there's a number of states that have trigger laws set in place, and a lot of them are in the middle of America, Texas on up. And I think that those states all having very strict laws on abortion is kind of going to create a block of inaccessibility. And I think that it's going to pigeonhole a lot of women into making choices. I personally know so many birth moms that say that I thought I was going to parent, and I got right up to the end and I just knew that I couldn't. I knew that it wasn't going to happen for me. The cards were not in my favor. It just didn't, the math wasn't mapping up to the end. And so they made a decision last minute to place. I think that this is, you may be seeing a lot of the similar situations. I don't believe that women are going to be sent away. The shame and secrecy piece, not that we can't revert back to that, and I hope we don't, but I don't think it's going to be as extreme as it was, because we live in a totally different society, different norm than we did back then. But I do think it's very possible that the numbers could rise, and which is why I'm so scared that we're just not ready for that.
I feel like we should also talk about the, and maybe Lori, this is where you were about to go, the drop boxes, the safe haven laws and the drop boxes, you know, kind of being offered as this easy solution. Just don't worry, just there's these safe haven boxes.
Yeah, and I think this goes to the simplicity. When we look at this in a simplistic model, we use the word just. If you can't build your family the old-fashioned way, you can just adopt. If you can't parent your child, you can just place the child for adoption. And if you get to, you know, where you have the child and you can't parent it, you just place it in this baby box. And we, when we look at it that way and we haven't walked that path, even in our minds, with compassion and empathy for the person making that decision and faced with that, just that horrible Sophie's choice of things, we come up with simplistic answers when we look at a simplistic model. So, I mean, the baby boxes themselves are to try to keep babies safe, but there's a cost to that too. You can probably speak to that, Sarah, of losing your identity. I'm sure there's a cost to the woman who that's her best option. That can't be good either, Kelsey. So let me, how does that feel for you too?
I will definitely say there's, that is a just is really insulting to me as an adoptee. It's really just kind of taking away any recognition of a connection between the biological mother and the child, and making light of it. And that is the dark ages of adoption. That's what we used to do. That was kind of the standard, is tabula rasa, blank slate, like just start fresh. And we know better now. I stand on the shoulders of lots of adoptees who've been speaking out and saying, no, that's not the case. It's not a blank slate. There is something that is meaningful in that connection. And so these just turning to the drop box is really just kind of making light of that. And that's not emotionally healthy for adoptees. I did grow up, you know, I was part of the very end of the baby scoop era. And that was the prevailing advice to parents. And it was bunk advice. It was not good to just ignore this connection and not honor where I came from, not honor my history. So it requires that we as adoptees, when we grow up, we've got to go find where we came from. And it makes it harder. There's no records now. It's like taking away even like it's beyond like it takes us back really far, because I mean, we still have closed records and inability to get our records, but now you've got drop boxes. So what does that mean for records? You know, I will say we have, DNA now, DNA testing. And so we can go that route as adults, if we've got the privilege and if we're willing to. I think what we also never talk about is, the cost of that. Like, we're giving our genetic material to, who knows where it's, what's going to happen with that. Like, but it's that important to us that it's almost ubiquitous now. Adoptees are doing that, ending that. So it's not keeping a secret anyway. And it's not right to the adoptees to have to do that. You know, we do the DNA. In my case, we had to front money. And luckily, this is a place of privilege. I had the privilege to be able to do that. A lot of adoptees adopted internationally have to travel overseas. These are things we do because it's so important to us. So if that's, you know, if we're willing to do all these things, it's because it's so deeply needed. And so just dropping off in a baby box is kind of arguing in the face of that and making light that none of this matters. Your history doesn't matter.
So about the safe haven baby boxes, I know the woman that created them, and I know, like, she's an adoptee. Actually, her reasoning for it, to me as an adoptive professional, has made sense. Like, for the creation of them, it's really more about, like, infanticide and stuff like that. But I do think that there's a huge gap there in the marketing, especially. I think it's gone just too far. I think that while we do want the women who are struggling with postpartum, you know, psychosis and those really heavy issues, that they may be considering ending the life of their already born child, I think in that case, oh my God, put this baby somewhere where they will be safe and taken somewhere safe, so that you don't have to, or your mind doesn't convince you that you have to make that choice. And I know people that there was a woman in my high school prom group who, killed her own born child as a result of psychosis. And I think that this is something that we as a society kind of look away from and dismiss it as evil. And we don't really try to understand what this woman is truly going through and how none of this has to happen. Because if she's cut off from community and resources and help and support and emotional well-being, this doesn't happen. And so while I really strongly feel that the safe haven option should be an option, just so to preserve the life of a child that's already been born and has a chance, I think that, but the marketing ploy of just do this, just do this, just do this, it's like, come on, you're succumbing to this decision to not educate the public. To not give humanity to these women and extend grace to these women and understanding of what this life is going to look like for this adoptee. I know that adoptees already struggle with abandonment issues. That will compound that, but we have to somehow bridge a resource in so that, hey, this isn't your only choice. If you need to place this child for adoption, this doesn't have to be like this. And legally speaking, there's so many gaps with this. Women come back. I've seen this happen a couple of times when I was working in Indiana. Women have come back to that fire station and asked, oh my God, I made a mistake. I need my baby back. Where's the disclaimer on that? Where's the information on that? She's going to put her baby in a box. Is she not going home with something? Like, is there not something in there that she's going home with? Or is she like, or something that says, you don't have to do this. Here's a number you can call for a safe family, for a resource, for some respite care. Like, that's my thing, is like, we're cutting off resources. We're just saying, open the box, close the box, walk away. Where's the rest of it?
Yeah. And Kelsey, I'm so thankful that you brought this up. And it makes me want to quote Dr. Joyce Pavo about, you know, adoption being a permanent solution to a temporary solution to a temporary situation. And I think, which we do say a lot, and that's what this just is kind of, it really shouldn't, these safe haven boxes really shouldn't necessarily be equated with adoption. I fully agree. I think mothers do need something. If you're in a different desperate situation, then like, let's tie that in with postpartum depression and psychosis and lack of support. Let's tie that education in around those boxes. It doesn't even need to be wrapped up with adoption. That those two things don't have to go hand in hand, right? Like that's really what it's about. And absolutely, parents should have a safe place. And I think what you're touching on and you spoke about, not just touched on, is just this, you know, we want to change Roe v. Wade and we're taking away choice, but where is the extra support for women in these situations and the maternal care that's needed and the support for people in desperate situations? Like we haven't addressed the social programs needed. We haven't fixed the adoption industry and so we're not ready. We're not ready right now.
Yeah. And that's where I was going with listening to both of you, zooming out from the individual stories of using adoption itself or safe haven boxes as a possible outcome. Let's talk infrastructure, because I think, you know, all adoptions are not the same. Within the US, there are two adoption streams. One is domestic infant adoption, where the adopting parents are paying the bills. And the other one is the foster or the welfare system, where the government is paying the bills. And so a safe haven, a baby placed in a safe haven box, not only does that mother not get support, but that mother, it's almost like a half of a choice instead of a full choice, because the mother is deciding part of it, but she's not deciding where that baby's going to go. She's not placing with enough support and consideration and forward-lookingness of this, as if she were going into a domestic infant adoption situation. This baby would probably go into the welfare system. And is overturning Roe going to lead to a lot more children in the welfare system, either just at birth or shortly after birth, for somebody who knew earlier on she was not ready to parent? And is our welfare system ready for all of that?
Well, no. I think one of the most frustrating things for me is that we've had 49 years since Roe has been a thing. And we really haven't changed much. As a society, I think we've moved along in terms of societal norms and our culture and everything. But I think that it's just like any other society, it's tough to move generations along simultaneously. And we've struggled with that. But I also think that in terms of like laws that have been made and restrictions that have been put on adoption professionals or regulations enforcement, like we really haven't done much. And I've seen just a lot of wasted time. And that's really frustrating to me. When I first placed for adoption, I think I was desperate for some sort of sense of community and understanding. And I was pretty involved in the pro-life community in my home state of Indiana for about 2 years, I would say. And then I kind of just didn't feel right about it anymore. I felt very used. I kind of just did some like a few speaking engagements on my story and overshared and the whole nine yards. And I feel like I got very frustrated and I felt I was a little naive entering into it too, thinking that my story could impact their opinion on adoption or just let them know that we have so much work to be done with supporting moms. And they didn't care about supporting birth moms, like with mental health. And like maybe some of them did, but as a whole, there was no action there. And that was really disappointing to me. And so I think that's what's disappointing is I know I'm not the first birth mom to go tell the pro-life community, hey, I need help. And I need more help than just a pat on the back. And here you can speak at our event. Like I need a therapist. I need continual support. I need to know that my child's okay. I need to know that I can have access to my child and see how they're doing and to have a relationship with them. I need more than the bare minimum. And so that's just such a point of frustration for me to see that the adoption choice is continually gets abandoned and it's not safe. It's not a safe choice for women. And it's like nothing's happened. Nothing's happened in 49 years to make anything better for them. We've just been in the center of a tug of war the whole time of ideology. That's really it. So the infrastructure thing is just a real point of frustration. There's so much that needs to be done: paid parental leave, postpartum services, mental health services, pre and postnatal counseling, and childcare, formula shortage, diapers, everything. I mean, we have a two-income household, and we struggle to buy diapers some months because it just gets so hard to juggle all the expenses of having a child and the healthcare expenses. And also you're expecting women to go with an unplanned pregnancy, go pay $5,000 to $15,000 or more to go have a child at the hospital, even with health insurance. These things are a huge problem. And it just seems so silly, you know? It's not, but it just seems absurd to think that it's more than just adoption, that this society is not ready for this at all.
So in this 49-year long argument between pro-life and pro-choice, what's been forgotten completely is how to help people parent more, who are on the cusp of those choices. Yeah, that's a good perspective.
And how to work through the issues in the adoption industry as well, right? Like, I mean, I think we need to be realistic. I think, you know, sometimes, I can find myself guilty of this, of kind of idealizing this scenario where there's no more adoption, you know, this world where every mother gets the support they need, but that's, adoption will still be a solution for many, and a choice for many. Roe v. Wade or not, abortion will still be a choice for many. These things are not going to go away. Lots of things, both of those, you know, like you said, Lori, just kind of in these years, everything, it's been pro-life, pro-choice, and we're not working on these broader issues in the meantime in the industry.
Yeah. And I should have said parenting well or adopting well. We didn't really put our attention and resources into better outcomes through those measures because we got lost with all the other noise.
So where do we go from here? I think, you know, in this conversation and then just both as we all work together, any of us in adoption land, I think what's our challenge? Where are you both landing?
For me, I wanted to give a shout out to this book that we've all read now, I think. What's it called? It's A Complicated Choice. Katie Zay, I believe is her name. She's the author. We've all read this book now in like the past week. I really liked it. Katie is an ordained Baptist minister, I believe. She talks about just the complexities of the choice and making space for grief and healing for these women who have had an abortion. I think that the approach of giving compassion, even just neutrally, even if you have mixed feelings on abortion, but offering compassion and extending that, I don't think that we really grasp how powerful that is to receive from someone in those really dark times. And giving these women a little grace, a little mercy, a little compassion, it's a really life-giving thing for them, for us. And I think that's our challenge for me personally. I've walked with a couple different friends who have had abortions, and it's been really challenging because that's not how my story panned out. But it's really tough sometimes when we're not in the mental space of taking ourselves out of the equation and just being there unconditionally for a friend. I think that's where we have to be. That's the challenge, is to take ourselves out of the center and put that person that maybe we don't even know into the center role and think of what they need. Not what we think is best for them, but what they need, what they're vocal about needing. I think, yeah, that's the challenge.
I think for me, the more I get into this issue, the more complex it becomes. It does not become clearer. And I think I would want people walking away from listening to us talk about it to remember that the complexity is not easy. And we need to look, especially on this issue, I think we need to look at unintended consequences that come from sweeping actions. And they can be from small things like using the meant to be narrative for your adoption. I'll put a link to a resource about that. That seems like it could not be harmful, but if you look deeper at the complexities, it can. It can be from using adoptees and usually young birth moms as props in one side or another. There's unintended consequences for doing that to people. And from taking away any choice for a woman to have who's in an unplanned pregnancy. And I'm going to put a link in here for a Freakonomics episode that's just really, really thought-provoking, adding to the complexity without really giving answers. But I think it's stuff we need to factor in as we try to figure out how, as a society, we're going to deal with this really thorny issue. Sarah?
God, you just said everything so well, both of you. So I that's exactly what I would say. I think, I guess my plea would be that for all of us, adoption land and outside of adoption land, to just be able to see nuance and complexity and make space for that. I think that can stretch us, that can grow us. It can not put adoptees in this, and not make us feel on the outside. We're already prone to feeling on the outside. And so any like black and white thinking that doesn't give us space for our full individuation puts us on the outside. And it doesn't, it's like I said at the beginning, it's primal. It doesn't, it's not good for our psychology. It's not good for our national, our country's psychology to be that dogmatic and black and white in our thinking. And again, like I said, I mean, just my spiritual belief is it's not good for our spiritual psychology either. And to not look around us and see that there's a lot of complexity in the world, and to have human compassion toward each other that takes precedent over a really strong-held belief. So it's about compassion. And I hope that that this conversation has helped to bring about that we've modeled compassion. I feel like this is a safe space, the three of us. So I appreciate each of you so much. And I hope that we've modeled giving each other, you know, hearing each other and hearing the different perspectives. And I hope that that's what we can all do going forward. That's what this world needs, this divided world needs.
So thanks for listening today. We, as you can tell, this is a topic that's hard to talk about. We're a little nervous. We are grateful that you stayed with us, and we would love to hear from you. If you have thoughts, nuances, perspectives we may have missed, please let us know in a comment on YouTube or on our webpage, threesidesadoption.com. We really, more learning is better. More voices are better. Let us know.